Today, we speak to Afua Hirsch about The Guardian's Bias in Britain series, which has uncovered the extent of racism and bias in the UK. And, in opinion, Kehinde Andrews argues that the time has come to rethink the historical figures that we revere. If I was to look at my own childhood, actually grappling with identity was probably the biggest single struggle. I mean, I was so desperate not to be Asian that when I was a kid, I used to put like talcum powder on my face. I wanted to be called Natalie. You know, if my mum was wearing a sari and we were out and about, I wouldn't want to walk with her.
Oh, that's so painful to hear. So like you, when I was seven, I went to a new school. I insisted that I be called Caroline. Which nobody took remotely seriously, and no one was willing to call me Caroline, but I just wanted to be like everyone else.
Growing up as an ethnic minority raises issues of identity, of belonging, and for many people, of racism. This week, The Guardian has published a major series called Bias in Britain, which examines people's everyday experiences. It reveals racial discrimination still exists in every area of British society. Guardian writer Afua Hirsch wants to talk about why.
So I struggled hugely with it, and I think that it's layered. It's difficult to be the person who doesn't look like everyone else in your school or your area. And it's also difficult to be in a society that really pummels you with certain ideas about beauty and European standards of beauty and whiteness as desirable and affluent and rich and successful. And that is changing, but not fast enough.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what does racism in Britain look like in 2018? Afua, a lot of The Guardian's reporting this week is focused on unconscious bias. When did you first come across that term?
Well, I remember when I understood when I first came across the term, which was in my 20s, I think.
And, oh, really?
Yeah. And it's one of a range of phrases that I just did not learn until later in my life. So unconscious bias, microaggressions, imposter syndrome. These are all words that I think would have really helped me, actually, if I'd have known them when I was younger. But it wasn't language that was available to me. And I think that having names for things really helps you structure your thinking around them.
Let's define unconscious bias. It's not the same as explicit racism, but it is discrimination all the same. It refers to the biases we are unaware of. When your brain makes incredibly quick judgments about people, influenced by your background, cultural environment, and personal experiences.
I think I've experienced unconscious bias all my life, and more than overt racism, because I have had experiences of overt racism, and a couple of them were scary, but on the whole, it's been unconscious bias or microaggressions or those things that you always have to question yourself and ask, am I just being paranoid? Am I imagining this?
No, you're not. Let's run through some of the Guardian findings. The poll found racial discrimination in the workplace, in the criminal justice system, and in everyday life when travelling, shopping, going to a restaurant or on a night out. I'll just give you some of the figures. 43% of ethnic minorities say they've been unfairly overlooked for a promotion at work, compared to 18% of white people. 38% say they've been treated as a potential shoplifter when they haven't done anything wrong, against 14% of white people. And as part of the coverage, Guardian reporters responded to almost 1,000 online advertisements for rooms to rent under the names of David and Mohammed. You can guess who got a much more positive response. Does any of this surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me, but I still think it's really important to measure it. And I think there are two different kinds of things as well that you've been measuring with this. One is these kind of like experiential things, you know, going into a restaurant and being told that it's full when you can see there's loads of empty tables, or feeling like something unfair has happened at work, or being followed around a shop by a security guard on the suspicion that you're stealing and you cannot help but suspect it's because of how you look.
Have you had that?
So many times. And actually, it's interesting, in my book, you know, I've written about lots of other big studies and inquiries that have been done. But the thing that people remember and ask me about is when I wrote about going into my local high street as a teenager and being told I wasn't welcome in the shop because black girls steal. And, God, you know, it's just kind of the place that I'd lived all my life that was, you know, And I went in there because my best friend from school had a Saturday job in there at the time. So I just went to see her and she was told to tell me that I shouldn't come again. It upset me and it threw me at the time. But there was also a level of, this is going to sound really weird, but almost a level of relief at somebody saying out loud the thing that I'd seen people thinking. As in, I'd noticed people looking at me suspiciously in these shops. But it's, I think a problem of our generation that we have made progress since previous generations. And that's good. That's great. You know, if I speak to people just 10 years older than me, I was born in 1981. People born in the early 70s talk about being beaten up after school by skinheads with baseball bats chasing them down the street. That never happened to me growing up. So that is progress. And I thought when I was growing up that that was racism, when you got beaten up by a skinhead or someone calling you the N-word or the P-word. That was racism.
And I was actually born in 1980. And I remember feeling a massive relief once when a white male kid, when I was probably about 12 or 13, said to me, "You're different to the other Packies." And I just remember thinking, oh, that's nice. So that means I'm okay. I can fit in, rather than thinking he's just said something awful and racist and terrible. And actually, I remember speaking to Sadiq Khan about these sort of things. And he talks about really terrible things happening when he was a child. There's a sense that things have changed since then. Do you think that sort of thing can still happen now?
I do. When I was growing up, I had a similar experience to you in that a group of my school friends said to me, "Don't worry, Af, we don't even see you as black. You're fine." And I was instinctively uncomfortable with that at the time, although I couldn't have articulated why. And I can totally imagine somebody saying that today, because I think that what my school friends were reacting to was all of this negative messaging that there is something bad about being black. And I don't think that's gone away. I think that we still get that messaging, you know.
And this data suggests it.
And this data is one of the reasons I welcome it, is that I wish we could be more forensic about it. You know, often it's anecdotal and it's experiential, and that's kind of inevitable given the nature of the beast. But I think the more we can find ways to measure it and actually confront the extent to which it's a problem, then the more likelihood we have of being able to progress.
And in terms of the experiences that people are having at the moment, the kind of reporting that we've been doing this week, to what extent is it racism and to what extent is it unconscious bias? And are they different?
Yeah, they are different. I think that one of the problems actually with racism in Britain is, and this is maybe a bit subtle, but we focus too much on racism as a set of prejudices rather than as a structural thing. So that's why I don't think we analyse the history of racism and the way it's actually been a tool for distributing resources and delineating what we call communities in our society. And we've thought of racism as something you do. I don't like you because you're brown. I don't like you because you're Muslim. I don't like you because you're black. That exists. And this poll speaks to that. But I think racism is much bigger than that, and it's structural as well. But as far as these interpersonal relationships go, there is a real complacency, in my opinion, that most people, there are still people who are visibly racist, and we know who they are, but most people don't consider themselves racist. And I think that makes people feel more comfortable about saying we've moved past race, you know, we're post-racial. There are black MPs, there are lots of black people in adverts for sofas, you know, whatever it is. We have moved beyond the time when it was acceptable to openly discriminate against people because of race. And like I said, we have made progress and that's good. But this is a lot bigger than that.
Can I ask about a clip of you I saw on Sky News that maybe illustrates some of the things that we've been talking about?
All over the world, statues are coming down. In just the last couple of weeks...
You were arguing that maybe it was time to pull down statues of people with links to slavery, like Nelson's Column. And the LBC presenter Nick Ferrari was on the same show, and he turned around to you and said,
"Why do you stay in this country? If you take such offence when you see Nelson's Column, if you take such offence when you hear Winston Churchill's name, who I would argue if..."
You look really shocked by that. How did it make you feel?
I was really shocked. I was really shocked, not because it's unusual for people to say, "If you don't like it here, why don't you go back to where you came from?" But because I didn't expect him to say that. And I feel that this idea, this really poisonous idea that my entitlement to be in my own country is kind of precarious and insecure, that idea has become mainstream, and that's new. You know, I now get my professional peers, people who would never consider themselves to be extremists, saying things like that. And I think this idea that I'm not fully British, despite the fact that I have never had any other nationality, it's really taken root. And that really troubles me, because I think it's just becoming more and more socially acceptable to have these ideas, and people are emboldened to say them.
So what do attitudes to race look like in 2018?
Well, in 2018, it's a good year in the sense it's been a bad year. So you think about Windrush.
The government is forced to apologise for what it calls its appalling treatment of Windrush immigrants. The Home Office admits some who arrived here from the Caribbean from 1948 onwards have been wrongly threatened with deportation.
Frankly, some of the way they have been treated has been wrong.
For many people, the Windrush story was a wake-up call about the fact that actually we really do have people who are second-class citizens because of the colour of their skin in this country. And then also this year we had a royal wedding, completely different kind of event. But I think...
Isn't it great though? Prince Harry married a black divorcee.
So the fact that I was considered a go-to commentator on a royal wedding tells you all you need to know.
You were on the BBC, weren't you?
It tells you all you need to know about how different this royal wedding was from all previous ones.
With us now to discuss the changing perceptions of the royal family and Meghan's role in all of that is writer, broadcaster and social commentator Afua Hirsch. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us.
Yeah, it's great to be here. What an amazing
day. You look guest ready.
Thank you.
Sans hat.
Well, you know, we are at the wedding.
Absolutely.
Right?
So listen,
because I can promise that nobody has ever been remotely interested in anything I've had to say about any royal wedding before. And suddenly I was being asked because I wrote about the racial symbolism of that wedding. And I think that I personally felt it was a really positive symbol of how our institutions can change. And I don't think it's a substitute for the kind of structural problems I'm talking about. You know, the royal family have actually been at the heart of some of the most systemic racism in this country for centuries. You know, Queen Elizabeth I personally funded the first slave voyage in this country, the first commercial slavery voyage. And that's a history that is never talked about and I think is still very taboo. But at the same time, for somebody like me growing up in Britain, I used to look at the royal family and to me, they symbolised all the reasons why I didn't feel I could properly be included in Britishness because they were so white. They didn't even seem to socialise with black people, let alone marry them. So I think that that did send a message to a younger me that actually there is nothing definitively white about being British and that people who look like us can be included in any part of this country. And that is an important thing. And I personally felt that it was a positive thing. And the fact that people were interested in what someone like me had to say, I think shows that they also thought there was something symbolically different.
Another story that caught my eye this year was when Home Secretary Sajid Javid tweeted about a convicted sexual grooming gang. And he wrote, "Sick Asian paedophiles, for too long they've been ignored. Not on my watch." On Monday, he defended that in an interview.
"For many years under successive governments, we have turned a blind eye to the obvious. And any normal person looking at the recent convictions of gangs that abuse children would have noticed that a majority, a vast majority, are from a Pakistani heritage. And we cannot ignore that."
What do you make of the Home Secretary using language like that?
That was, I think, one of the most serious incidents for me this year in terms of the symbolism around race. To hear the Home Secretary saying that these grooming gangs disgrace, or, you know, disgrace my heritage. In that statement, he was suggesting that the activities of one group of depraved individuals says something about an entire community. And that is straight back to the ideology of 100 years ago. It is so regressive. And, you know, it's this idea that you don't challenge the racialized ideas about a group of people. You just say that one person is exempt from them. And for him to feed into that is a complete betrayal.
You know, actually, can't you see this in a different way, which is he's a very senior Muslim politician who's family came to this country, whose mum didn't speak any English, who has spoken about his experiences, who has, you know, taken racism as an issue and not been afraid to talk about it, and who has been incredibly successful. And perhaps Sadiq Khan as well. Don't you think that they are doing something that will really challenge racism in this country?
I think that first of all, Sajid Javid has had quite a lot of racist abuse, and I've been one of the first people to condemn that, because I don't think that it's ever okay to be racist to anyone. I think that Sajid Javid is actually a good example of the complexity of the problem. It's good to have diversity. It's good to have people from different backgrounds in positions of power and influence and visibility. But until we change our cultural thinking about race, it actually doesn't make any difference unless they can be true to their experience and they do not feel the pressure to downplay their difference. It's very common, actually, that people who go into white spaces who are from minority backgrounds feel the need to disappear their difference, you know, to downplay it, to just make themselves blend in. That's because whiteness is still the prevalent culture and everybody's expected to conform to it. And that goes against the whole point of diversity. Diversity is pointless if it's not changing the culture. Otherwise, it's just shoehorning people with brown skin into the pre-existing culture and not allowing them to affect any change.
So just finally, what can we actually do? What things should people be doing to change this?
One of the things I think is really powerful about this Guardian reporting on Bias Britain is that it helps further our understanding of the experiences of people of colour. But I think that people of colour, people from ethnic minority backgrounds, we do already know our experience. You know, anecdotally, we know our experience. We talk to each other about it. We know about our identities because we're constantly being reminded that we are other. White British people, on the other hand, I think don't often know they're white, or they don't know what whiteness is, or that it also has a history and a content and an ideology around it as an identity. And I think that that is a really useful area for people to know that everybody has an identity that has content. And that if we start from that place, we also stop thinking about these as problems for ethnic minority people to deal with. I think we do still have this idea in society that racism, bias, prejudice, it's a problem for us to carry. You know, it's our issue. It's our niche little minority issue. It's not. If you care about living in a society that allocates opportunity in a fair way and not based on race, then we should all care about this. It's bad for all of us.
And in terms of concrete action?
So first of all, I think we need to talk about whiteness. I think we all need to talk about our identities. We need to develop a better language because we're using people of colour, ethnic minorities, BAME, because it's what we've got, but none of it is really satisfactory. And I think you get the language that you deserve based on what you think about. We haven't been doing the thinking in this country, so it's no surprise we have quite blunt instruments in terms of our language. I think we need to start mainstreaming this into all of our political and policy debate. You know, when we have austerity, how it affects people from different minority communities should be at the heart of it. When we talk about Brexit, how it's going to affect people from minority communities should be at the heart of it. All of this policy, everything we do in the public sector, affects people disproportionately when they're from minority backgrounds, because they are, as we have seen time and time again, at the receiving end of public services and narratives as well in a different way. But it's something that's ignored most of the time, and then there's this one race thing that happens. We talk about race and we go back to talking about everything as usual, and we still haven't accepted that these communities are not separate communities. They are British. They are core constituents in Britishness and Britain, and that they should be part of all of our thinking.
Apa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Guardian's Bias in Britain series is running all this week. Follow the reporting in the paper and on the website. Now, we spoke during that piece about Afua arguing that there were some controversial historical figures who maybe we should rethink celebrating. After the break, Kehinde Andrews asks whether it's time to pull down the statues of Lord Nelson, Cecil Rhodes and Winston Churchill. Welcome back. Now, Dr. Kehinde Andrews, Professor of Black Studies at Birmingham City University, on rethinking which historical figures we honour.
So I'm often invited to speak about British historical figures or wider European historical figures. And without fail, it's always an emotional debate. It's never a rational, reasoned, measured debate. This stirs up a kind of really strong backlash from people. So it kind of shows that you just can't have this discussion in a kind of reasoned way. The debates about taking down statues of particular figures are never actually about the statues at all. I mean, a statue is just an image, but the question is, what does that image represent? Who is it that we valorize and put out to the public? this really is actually quite a high-stakes discussion in a sense. When people are arguing against taking down statues, again, this is also not really about the statue. This is about defending a particular version of history where you can find positives in people like Rhodes or people like Churchill or people like Nelson. Because, again, if you have to deal with the fact that these are problematic figures, you have to deal with the wider fact that the history is problematic as well. There is also something personal at stake in this idea as well, because, you know, people see themselves as British, and that means something to people. People are very proud of being British. That's why they wave the flags, etc., etc. And so when you're talking about critiquing what these British figures are and what the history of Britain is, you really are, in a very real way, talking about critiquing people's personal connection to themselves, right? I think that's also why there is such an emotional part of this, because it is getting into that level of, well, actually, how do I see myself in the world? Yeah, it is scary for people to face up to the truth about history, and it also should be scary to face up to the truth about history. To admit that your history and your country is built on racial oppression is kind of like unraveling. It's like you pull a cord and then it unravels the whole thing. One of the ways that the current system is maintained is by people believing that Britain and the West more generally is built on a kind of tradition of progressivism and the great ideals, those things like British values, for example. So to look at back at these historical figures, people like Churchill or people like the great thinkers like Locke, etc., etc., it doesn't take much to scratch behind the surface and find out that they're not only were they racist, their ideas are racist, their politics are racist, and their practice was racist. To acknowledge this would mean that we have to acknowledge that what we have in Britain is fundamentally built on racial oppression, and people don't want to do that, right? So you have to kind of maintain these mythic fantasies of people in order to maintain the idea that Britain is built on something other than what it really is based on. I think what we really need to have is an honest discussion about the contribution. So that doesn't mean that people haven't contributed or done good things. Even take someone like Churchill. Look, Churchill was instrumental in winning the Second World War, which was very important. So I can accept that. I wouldn't say that's not true. But that doesn't mean you can neglect and forget the fact that he was also instrumental in the death of 3 million people in the Bengal famine, because he didn't believe the Indians really was that important to send food and stop the famine early. To bring in a critique about some of these figures, Churchill, Nelson, etc., etc., is heresy. And it's ironic, because actually what we're always told is that we have to have reason and debate and rationality, and that's what makes Britain Britain. But there's no application of any of those ideas when it comes to properly assessing the historical figures of the nation. There's definitely a focus on things like statues and even things like safe spaces in universities, things like these things, which aren't really the issue we're fighting for, because that is a way to kind of trivialise the issue, right? Like, you know, it's just about a statue, what are you complaining about, etc., etc. So it's kind of ironic in a sense to say that these things aren't important and then to defend them quite strongly. Right? I mean, the people who get most upset about the issue of statues are not the people who bring up the statue, because for us it's not really about the statues, it's about what they represent. The people who get so more emotional and more invested in maintaining the statues are those people who want to keep the status quo.
That's it for today. My thanks to Afua Hirsch and Kehinde Andrews. The producers of today's episode were Rachel Humphreys, Josh Kelly and Leah Green. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executives were Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. See you tomorrow.